million live in Pakistan, and 12.5 million of them live in Afghanistan. That's 42% of the entire population. There are about 88,000 living in Britain and 44,000 in the USA. In Afghanistan, they live primarily in the mountains of the northeast, and they also have heavily populated areas in the east and south. They are proud people who adhere to Islam and live by a strict code of honor and culture, observing rules and laws known as Pashtunwali, which has kept them straight for 2,000 years. They're also the quintessential supporters of the Taliban. Their warriors form the backbone of the Taliban forces, and their families grant those forces shelter in high mountain villages, protecting them and providing refuge in places that would appear almost inaccessible to the Western eye. That, by the way, does not include U.S. Navy SEALs, who do have Western eyes, but who don't do inaccessible. We can get in anywhere. It's easy to see why the Pashtuns and the Taliban get along just fine. The Pashtuns were the tribe who refused to buckle under the army of the Soviet Union. They just kept fighting. In the 19th century, they fought the British to the verge of surrender and then drove them back into Pakistan. 300 years before that, they wiped out the army of Akbar the Great, the most fearsome of India's Mughal rulers. Those Pashtuns are proud of their stern military heritage, and it's worth remembering that in all the centuries of bitter, savage warfare in Baluchistan, during which time they were never subdued, half the population was always Pashtun. The concept of tribal heritage is very rigid. It involves bloodlines, amazing lineages that stretch back through the centuries, generation after generation. You can't join a tribe in the way you can become an American citizen. Tribes don't hand out green cards or passports. You either are, or you aren't. The people are organized strictly by relationships, male relationships, that is. The tribal lineage descends from the father's side, the male ancestors. I understand they don't give a damn for mom or her ancestors. Inheritances are strictly for the boys, and land rights go directly to sons. They have a proverb that says a lot. I against my brothers and I against my cousins, my cousins and I against the world. That's how they do it. The tight military formation has again and again allowed them to knock 8 bells out of more sophisticated invaders. The tribal code, Pashtunwali, has heavy demands, hospitality, generosity, and the duty to avenge even the slightest insult. Life among the Pashtuns is demanding. It demands on the respect of your peers, relatives, and allies, and that can be dangerous. Only the tribe's principles of honor stand in the way of anarchy. A tribesman will fight or even kill in order to avoid dishonor to himself and his family. And killing throws the whole system into confusion, because death must be avenged. Killers and their families are under permanent threat, which puts a big air brake on violence. According to the learned Charles Lindhorn, a professor of anthropology at Boston University, homicide rates among the Pashtun tribes are way lower than homicide rates in urban areas of the United States. The Pashtun tradition of generous hospitality, perhaps their finest virtue, includes the concept of loke warkawal. It means giving of a pot. It implies protection for an individual, particularly in a situation where the tribe might be weaker than its enemies. When a tribe accepts loke, it undertakes to safeguard and protect that individual from an enemy at all costs. I, perhaps above all other Western visitors, have reason to be eternally grateful for it. We were on our final approach to the enormous U.S. base at Bagram. Everyone was awake now, 7 hours after we left Bahrain. It was daylight, and down below we could see at last the mountains we had heard so much about and among which we would be operational in the coming weeks. There was still snow on the high peaks, glittering white in the rising sun. Here we were at last, in the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, a country the size of Texas, landlocked on all sides, protected by the granite walls of mountains, war-torn for years and years, and still at it. Just like always, warlords were trying to drive out the usurpers. Us. And we weren't even usurping. Just trying to stop another bloody tribal upheaval and another regime change from the elected to the dictators. It seemed like a hell of a task. But we were excited. This was what we joined for. Danny, Shane, James, Axe, Mikey, and I. We were here on business, trained to the minute, armed to the teeth, all set to drive the armies of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda right back to where they came from, seize the leaders, and get rid of anyone too dangerous to live. and restore order to the mountains. A school for warriors. Only men who've gone through what we SEALs went through can understand the difference between us and the rest. In the military, even the rest understand what it takes to scale the heights of combat excellence. And in my case, it started inauspiciously. Way down on the ranch, with Mom in tears, refusing to leave the house to see me go. March 7th, 1999. I was 23. I decided to get out of town and join the U.S. Navy SEALs. Naturally, I told the recruiters there was no need for me to attend boot camp. I was already way too advanced for that. Yes, sir, I'll go straight to Coronado, where the big dogs eat. That's what I'm all about. I'm a half-trained SEAL already. They sent me directly to boot camp. I signed the papers and prepared to report for duty in a few days. My destination was more than 1,000 miles to the north, Navy Recruit Training Command, RTC, in Great Lakes, Illinois. And I can truthfully say it was where I spent the most miserable 8 weeks of my entire life. I had never even seen snow, and I arrived in the middle of the worst blizzard that boot camp had seen in 11 years. It was like sending a Zulu to the North Pole. That wind and snow came howling in across Lake Michigan, blasting its way onto the western shore where we were situated, 35 miles north of Chicago, right on the water. I could not believe the sheer misery of that freezing weather. The camp was a gigantic place, with hundreds of recruits trying to make that miraculous transformation from civilian to U.S. Navy sailor. It was a drastic metamorphosis, both mental and physical, and it would have been difficult enough in fine weather. But in that ice, snow, and wind, Jesus, words fail me. In that first week, while we were trying to avoid freezing to death, they instilled in us 3 words which have been with me ever since. Honor, courage, commitment, the motto of the United States Navy, the core values that immediately became the ideals we all lived by. I can remember to this day an instructor telling us, "What you make of this experience here at Great Lakes is what will make you as a person." He was right, I hope. In the second week, they put us through the confidence course. This is designed to simulate emergency conditions in a U.S. Navy warship. They taught us to be sharp, self-reliant, and above all, to make key decisions on which our lives and those of our shipmates might depend. That word, teamwork. It dominates and infiltrates every single aspect of life in the Navy. Week 3, they put us on board a land-bound training ship. Everything was hands-on training. We learned the name of nearly every working part of that ship. They taught us first aid techniques, signaling ship to ship with flags, semaphore. We spent a lot of time in the classroom where we focused on Navy customs and courtesies, the laws of armed conflict, shipboard communication, ship and aircraft identification, and basic seamanship. All this was interspersed with physical training tests, sit-ups, sit-reaches, and push-ups. I was fine with all those, but the 1.5-mile run in that weather would have tested the stamina of a polar bear. They told us anyone who failed could come back and take it again. I decided I would rather run barefoot across the Arctic than take it again. Gave it my all. Passed, thank God. During week 4, we got our hands on some weaponry for the first time, the M16 rifle. I was pretty quick with that part of the course, especially on the live fire range. The firefighting and shipboard damage control course came next, and we all learned how to extinguish fires, escape smoke-filled compartments, open and close watertight doors, operate the oxygen breathing apparatus, and move fire hoses around. The last part was the worst, the confidence chamber. You get in there with your class and put on a gas mask. Then someone unleashes a tear gas tablet, and you have to take off your mask, throw it in a trash can, and recite your full name and social security number. Every single recruit who joins the Navy has to endure that exercise. At the end, the instructors make it clear. You have what it takes. There's a place in the Navy for you. The final task is called battle stations. Teams are presented with 12 situations, all of which have been addressed during the previous weeks. This is where they grade the recruits individually and as teams. When you've completed this, the trainers present you with a U.S. Navy ball cap, and that tells the world you are now a sailor. You've proved you belong, proved you have the right stuff. The following week, I graduated in my brand new dress uniform. I remember passing the mirror and hardly recognizing myself. There's something about graduating from boot camp. I guess it's mostly pride in yourself, but you also know a lot of people couldn't have done it. Makes you feel pretty good. Especially someone like me whose major accomplishment thus far had involved hurling some half-drunk cowboy out of an East Texas bar and into the street on his ear. After I graduated, I flew immediately to San Diego, headed to Coronado Island and the Navy Amphibious Base. We went for runs along the beach, trying to get in shape for the first week of indoctrination. That's the two-week course known as Indoc, where the SEALs prepare you for the fabled Bud S course, basic underwater demolition SEALs. The SEAL programs make no distinction between commissioned officers coming in from the fleet and the rest of us. We're all in it together, and the first thing they instill in you at Indoc is that you will live and train as a class, as a team. Sorry, did I say instill in you? I meant ram home with a jackhammer. Teamwork, teamwork, teamwork. This is also where you first understand the concept of a swim buddy, which in SEAL ethos is an absolutely gigantic deal. You work with your buddy as a team. You never separate, not even to go to the John. In IBS, that stands for inflatable boat, small, training. If one of you falls over the side into the freezing ocean, the other joins him. Immediately. In the pool, you're never more than an arm's length away. Later on, in the Bud S course proper, you can be failed out of hand, thrown out, for not staying close enough to your swim buddy. And this all comes back to that ironclad SEAL folklore. We never leave a man behind on the battlefield, dead or alive. No man is ever alone. Whatever the risk to the living, however deadly the opposing fire, SEALs will fight through the jaws of death to recover the remains of a fallen comrade. It's a maxim that has survived since the SEALs were first formed in 1962, and it still applies today. I suffered a minor setback in the early part of that summer when I was in class 226. I managed to fall from about 50 feet up a climbing rope and really hurt my thigh. The instructor rushed up to me and demanded, "You want to quit?" "Negative," I responded. "Then get right back up there," he said. I climbed again, fell again. Somehow I kept going. The leg hurt like hell, but I kept training for another couple of weeks before the medics diagnosed a cracked femur. I was immediately on crutches, but still hobbling along the beach and into the surf with the rest of them. Eventually, when the leg healed, I was put back and then joined Bud S Class 228 in December for Phase 2. We lived in a small barracks right behind the Bud S Grinder. That's the blacktop square where a succession of SEAL instructors have laid waste to thousands of hopes and dreams and driven men to within an inch of their lives. It was only the first day of Indoc, and my little room was positioned right next to the showers. Showers, by the way, is a word so polite it's damn near a euphemism. They were a whole lot closer to a goddamn car wash and were known as the decontamination unit. Someone cranked them up at around 0400 and the howl of compressed air and freezing cold pressurized water forcing its way through those pipes sounded like someone was trying to strangle a steam engine. Jesus. First time I heard it, I thought we were under attack. But I knew the drill. Get into my canvas UDT swim trunks and then get under those ice-cold water jets. The shock was unbelievable. The damn thing was actually designed to power wash our sand-covered gear when we returned from the beach. The shock was reduced somewhat then because everyone had just been in the Pacific Ocean. But right out of bed, at 4 o'clock in the morning? Wow. That was beyond reason. And I can still hear the sound of those screaming, hissing water pipes. Freezing cold and wet, we reported to the training pool to roll and stow the covers. Then shortly before 0500, in the pitch dark, we lined up on the grinder and sat in rows, chest to back, very close to conserve body heat. We had a class leader by now, Lieutenant David Ismay, a Naval Academy man and former Rhodes Scholar who had had 2 years at sea and was now a qualified surface warfare officer. David was desperate to achieve his lifelong dream of becoming a SEAL. He had to do this right. Officers only got one shot at Bud S. The man we all awaited was our proctor. That's the instructor assigned to guide us, teach us, torture us, observe us, and get rid of us if necessary. He was instructor Reno Alberto, a 5'6" man mountain of fitness, discipline, and intelligence. He was a ruthless, cruel, unrelenting taskmaster. He arrived at 0500 sharp, and we'd have a ritual which was never broken. This was how it went.
Feet!
Shouted the class leader.
Feet!
An echoing roar ripped into the still night air as nearly 164 of us responded and jumped to our feet, attempting to move into ranks.
Instructor Reno! Called the class leader. Hoo-yah, Instructor Reno!
We bellowed as one voice. Hoo-yah is a Bud S thing, and its origins are lost in antiquity. It was pitch dark, and Reno was wearing sunglasses, wraparound shiny black. Seemed he never took them off, night or day. Actually, one time I did catch him without them, and as soon as he saw me, he reached into his pocket and immediately put them on again. I think it was because he never wanted us to see the expression in his eyes, which might reveal the amusement he must have felt about the Attila the Hun act he put on for us.
Drop!
Reno said without expression.
Drop!
We roared back, as we all struggled down to the concrete and assumed a position for push-ups, arms extended, bodies outstretched, rigid.
Push 'em out, said Reno. Push-ups,
snapped the class leader.
Push-ups,
we responded.
Down, one, down, two.
We counted out every one of the 20 push-ups in the set, then returned to the rest position, arms outstretched. The class leader called out,
Instructor Reno! Hoo-yah, Instructor Reno!
We roared. He ignored us, then said quietly,
Push him out.
As he did twice more, at which point he left us with muscles on fire in the straight arm, outstretched rest position. He actually left us there for almost 5 minutes, and everyone's arms were throbbing. 80 push-ups and now this new kind of agony, which ended only when he said very slowly, very quietly,
Recover.
Reno surveyed his kingdom and then spoke flatly.
Most of you aren't gonna be here in a couple of months.
He then told us we were again about to take the basic Bud S screening test. I graphically recall him reminding us we'd all passed it once in order to make it this far.
If you can't pass it again this morning,
he added,
you'll be back in the fleet as soon as we can ship you out.
Before us was the 5-point screening test. 1. A 500-yard swim, breaststroke or sidestroke, in 12 minutes 30 seconds. 2. A minimum of 42 push-ups in 2 minutes. 3. A minimum of 50 sit-ups in 2 minutes. 4. A minimum of 6 dead hang pull-ups. 5. A 1.5-mile run in 11 minutes 30 seconds done while wearing boots and long pants. Only one guy failed to complete. In fact, most of us did markedly better than we had the first time. I recall I managed close to 80 push-ups and 100 sit-ups. I guess the apparition of Billy Shelton was standing hard by my shoulder. More important, Instructor Reno was watching us with eyes like a fighter jet's radar. He told me several months later he knew I was putting out for him. Made up his mind about me right then and there. Told me he'd never changed it either. Good decision. I give it everything. On time, every time. Might not always be good enough, but it's always my very best shot. Looking back, I'm not sure that early test showed very much. There were a lot of heavily muscled bodybuilding types who looked pretty ferocious. I remember they were among the very first to go, because they just couldn't hack it. Their legs and upper bodies were just too heavy. The SEALs do place a premium on brute strength, but there's an even bigger premium on speed. That's speed through the water, speed over the ground, and speed of thought. There's no prizes for a gleaming set of well-oiled muscles in Coronado. Bulk just makes you slow, especially in soft sand, and that's what we had to tackle every day of our lives, mile after mile. On this first morning of Class 226, we immediately learned another value peculiar to Bud S. We don't stroll, walk, or even jog. We run. We actually run like hell. Everywhere. All day. Our first encounter with this cruel and heartless rule came when it was time for breakfast. The chow hall was a mile away, so we had to run 2 miles, there and back, for a plate of toast, eggs, and bacon. Same for lunch, same for dinner. And for anyone mathematically challenged, that's 6 miles every day just to find something to eat. Nothing to do with our regular daily training runs, which often added up to another 8 miles. That morning, Instructor Reno pulled himself up to his full height of about 15 feet, in my eyes, and told us he wanted to talk to us briefly. And we better pay attention.
"This is high-risk training," he said. "And we define that as anywhere there is potential for serious injury or loss of life. Any of you see anything unsafe or any situation where you may be in unnecessary danger, speak up immediately. We do not like mistakes. Understand me?"
"Hoo-yah!"
"Always remember your own accountability to yourselves, your superiors, and your teammates. The chain of command is sacred. Use it. Keep your boat crew leaders and your class leaders informed of any digression from the normal, and stay with your swim buddy. I don't care if you're going to the head, you stay right with him. Understood?"
"Hoo-yah!"
"Respect. I expect you to show complete respect for the instructor staff, the class officers, and the senior petty officers. You are in the military. You will be courteous at all times. Understood?"
"Hoo-yah!"
"Integrity, gentlemen. You don't lie, cheat, or steal, ever. You lose an item of gear, you put in a chit and report it. You do not take someone else's gear. I won't pretend that has not happened here in the past, because it has. But those guys were instantly finished. Their feet never touched the ground. They were gone. That day, you will respect your classmate and his gear. You do not take what is not yours. Understood?"
"Hoo-yah!"
"I'm your class proctor for the next 2 weeks, and I'll help you if you need help. Over matters of pay, family, and personal concerns, if you get injured, go to medical and get it fixed and get back into training. I'm your proctor, not your mother. I'm here to teach you. You stay in the box, I'll help you. You get outside the box, I'll hammer you. Understood?"
"Hoo-yah!"
"Finally, reputation. And your reputation begins right here, and so does the reputation of Class 226, and that's a reflection on me. It's a responsibility I take very personally, because reputation is everything. In life, and especially right here in Coronado, so stay focused. Keep your head right in the game. Put out 100% at all times, because we'll know if you don't. And never, ever leave your swim buddy. Any questions?"
"Negative!"
Who could ever forget that? Not me. I could still hear in my mind the sharp crack as Instructor Reno snapped shut his notebook. Sounded to me like Moses hammering together the granite slabs which held the Ten Commandments. We had a new instructor for the pool, and we were all driven through the ice-cold jets of the decontamination unit to get rid of the sand on our skin. That damn thing would have blasted the scales off a fresh haddock. After that, we piled into the water, split into teams, and began swimming the first of about 10 million lengths we would complete before our years of service to the Navy were complete. They concentrated on buoyancy control and surface swimming for the first few days. Made us stretch our bodies, made us longer in the water, timing us, stressing the golden rule for all young SEALs. You must be good in the water, no matter what. And right here, the attrition began. One guy couldn't swim at all. Another swore to God he'd been told by physicians that he should not put his head underwater under any circumstances whatsoever. That was two down. They made us swim without putting our heads up. Taught us to roll our heads smoothly in the water and breathe that way, keeping the surface calm, instead of sticking our mouths up for a gulp of air. They showed us the standard SEAL swim method, a kind of side stroke that's ultra-efficient with flippers. They taught us the technique of kick, stroke, and glide, the beginning of the fantastic SEAL underwater system that enables us to gauge distances and swim beneath the surface with astounding accuracy. They taught us to swim like fish, not humans. And they made us swim laps of the pool using our feet only. They kept telling us that for other branches of the military, water is a pain in the ass. For us, it's a haven. They were relentless about times, always trying to make us faster, hitting the stopwatches a few seconds sooner every day. They insisted brute strength was never the answer. The only way to find speed was technique, and then more technique. Nothing else would work. And that was just the first week. In the second, they switched us to training almost entirely underwater throughout the rest of the course. Nothing serious. They just bound our ankles together and then bound our wrists together behind our backs and shoved us into the deep end. This caused a certain amount of panic, but our instructions were clear. Take a huge gulp of air and drop to the bottom of the pool in the standing position. Hold it there for at least a minute, bob up for new air, then drop back down for another minute, or more if you could.
The instructor swam alongside us, wearing fins and masks, looking like porpoises, kind of friendly in the end, but at first glance a lot like sharks. The issue was panic. If a man was prone to losing it under the water when he was bound hand and foot, then he probably was never going to be a frogman. The fear is too deeply instilled. I was leader in the 50-yard underwater swim without fins. I already knew the secret to underwater swimming. Get real deep, real early. You can't get paid for finding the car keys if you can't get down there and stay down. We took ropes with us underwater. It was a series of naval knots that had to be completed deep below the surface. We lost several more guys during that drown-proofing part of the in-dock training. And while we were jumping in and out of the pool in the Pacific, we were also subjected to a stringent regime of physical training, high-pressure calisthenics. Instructor Reno and his men did their level best to level us. Oh, and for the good old days of 20 arm-tearing push-ups? Not anymore. Now it was usually 50 at a time, all interspersed with exercises designed to balance and hone various muscle groups, especially arms and abs. The instructors were consumed with abdominal strength, the reasons for which are now obvious. The abdomen is the bedrock of a warrior's strength for climbing rocks and ropes, rowing, lifting, swimming, fighting, and running. Back there in Indoc, we did not really get that. All we knew was the SEAL instructors were putting us through hell on a daily basis. My personal hell was the flutter kick. Lie on your back, legs dead straight and 6 inches off the sand, point your toes, and then kick as if you were doing the backstroke in the pool. And don't even consider putting your legs down because there were instructors walking past at all times, like they were members of a firing squad under the orders of the Prince of Darkness. The obstacle course, known to us as the O course, is a place of such barbaric intensity that real live SEALs, veteran combat warriors from the teams, supplement their training there, often preparing for overseas deployment to a theater of war, jungle, mountain, ocean, or desert. The Coronado O course was world famous, and if it tested the blooded warriors of the teams, imagine what it was like for us, 10-day wonders, fresh out of boot camp, soft as babies compared to these guys. I stared at the O course first day we went there. We were shown around the rope climbs, the 60-foot cargo net, the walls, the vaults, the parallel bars, the barbed wire, the rope bridges, the Weaver, the Burma Bridge. For the first time, I wished to hell I'd been a foot shorter. It was obvious to me this was a game for little guys. Instructor Reno gave a couple of demonstrations. It was like he'd been born on the rope bridge. It would be more difficult for me. All climbing is, because in the end, I have to haul 230 pounds upward, which is why all the world's great climbers are tiny guys with nicknames like the Fly, or the Flea, or Spider, all of them 118 pounds soaking wet. But there were a lot of very big SEALs, and they'd all done it. That meant I could do it. Anyway, my mindset was the same old, same old. I'm either going to do this right, or I'll die trying. That last part was closer to the reality. Those instructors are out there patrolling the corridors of our barracks by night into the small hours. One of them once came into my room after I'd hot-mopped it and high-polished the floor till you could almost see your face in it. He dropped a trickle of sand onto the floor and chewed me out for living in a dust bowl. Then he sent me down to the Pacific, in the company of my swim buddy and, of course, himself, to get wet and sandy, which meant that I had to go for a swim and then roll in the sand. Then we had to go through the decontamination unit, and the shrieking of those cold hydraulic pipes and the ferocious jets of water awakened half the barracks and nearly sent us into shock. Never mind the fact that it was 0200 and we were due back under those showers again in another couple of hours. I think that was the night my roommate quit. He went weak at the knees just watching what was happening to me. One time during Indoc, while we were out on a night run, one of the instructors actually climbed up the outside of a building, came through an open window, and absolutely trashed a guy's room, threw everything everywhere, emptied detergent over his bed gear. He went back out the way he'd come in, waited for everyone to return, and then tapped on the poor guy's door and demanded a room inspection. The guy couldn't work out whether to be furious or heartbroken, but he spent most of the night cleaning up and still had to be in the showers at 0430 with the rest of us. I asked Reno about this weeks later, and he told me, "Marcus, the body can take damn near anything. It's the mind that needs training." question that guy was being asked involved mental strength. Can you handle such injustice? Can you cope with that kind of unfairness, that much of a setback, and still come back with your jaw set, still determined, swearing to God you will never quit? That's what we're looking for. Welcome to hell, gentlemen. I realized we had been losing guys fairly steadily, but according to these numbers, Class 226 had had 164 men assigned on the first day, and we lost more than 50 of them. I know a few never showed up at all, mostly through sheer intimidation, but the rest had somehow vanished into the void. I never saw any of them leave, not even my roommate. Instructor Reno now spoke formally.
You're on your way to first phase Bud S, and I want each and every one of you to make me proud. Those of you who survive Hell Week will still have to face the pool competency test. That's in second phase, and then the weapons practicals in third phase. But I want to be at your graduation. And right there, I want to shake your hand. I want to think of you as one of Reno's warriors.
Hoo-yah, Instructor Reno!
For those of you who make the teams, remember you're joining a brotherhood. You'll be closer to those guys than you ever were to friends in school or college. You'll live with them. And, in combat, some of you may die with them. Your family must always come first, but the Brotherhood is a privileged place, and I don't want you ever to forget it.
Enter Instructor Sean Murrock, ex-SEAL from Team 2, veteran of 3 overseas deployments. In the following few minutes, he ran through the myriad of tasks we must complete after hours in first phase. Stuff like preparing the boats and vehicles, making sure we had the right supplies. He told us he expected 100% at all times, because if we did not put out, we'd surely pay for it. He gave us one last warning.
You're an official class now. First phase owns you.
Then, Ensign Joe Burns, a grim-looking SEAL commander, took his place in front of us and informed us he was the first phase officer. A few of us flinched. Burns' reputation as a hard man had preceded him.
I understand you all want to be frogmen.
Hoo-yah!
I guess we'll see about that, said Ensign Burns. Find out how bad you really want it.
Finally, we formed up, for the first time, on the most notorious square of black tarmac in the entire United States Armed Forces. It was 0515, and our places were marked by little frog flippers painted on the ground. It was hardly worth the visit.
Hit the surf! Get wet and sandy!
Yelled Chief Stephen Schultz.
Fast!
Our adrenaline pumped, our legs pumped, our arms pumped, our hearts pumped, every goddamn thing there was pumped as we thundered off the blacktop, still dressed in our squelching boots and fatigue pants, went back down to the beach and hurled ourselves into the surf. Jesus, it was cold. The waves broke over me as I struggled back into the shallows, flung myself onto the sand, rolled over a couple times and came up looking like Mr. Sandman, except I wasn't bringing anyone a dream. I could hear the others all around me, but I'd heard Schultz's last word. Fast. And I remembered what Billy Shelton had taught. Pay attention to even the merest suggestion. And I ran for my goddamn life, straight back to the grinder, right up with the leaders.
Too slow, bellowed Schultz. Much too slow. Drop!
Schultz's instructors roamed among us, berating us, yelling, harassing us as we sweated and strained to make the push-ups.
Like a goddamn fairy. Get a grip on yourself.
Oh, for Christ's sake, look as if you mean it.
Come on, let's go, go, go.
You sure you want to be here? You want to quit right now?
I learned in the next few minutes there was a sharp difference between get wet and sandy and just plain get wet. Parked at the side of the grinder were two of the inflatable boats, laden to the gunwales with ice and water. Get wet meant plunge over the bow, under the water, under the rubber seat struts, and out to the other side. 5 seconds, in the dark, in the ice, under the water. A killer whale would have begged for mercy. The water in that little boat would have frozen the balls off a brass monkey. I came out of there almost blue with the cold, ice in my hair, and blundered my way to my little frogman's marker, where two instructors were going down the lines with freezing cold power hoses, spraying everyone from the head down. By 0600, I counted out more than 450 push-ups. And there were more. I just couldn't count anymore. I'd also done more than 50 sit-ups. We were ordered from one exercise to another, Guys who were judged to be slacking were ordered to throw in a set of flutter kicks. The result of this was pure chaos. Some guys couldn't keep up. Others were doing push-ups when they'd been ordered to do sit-ups. Men were falling, hitting the ground, face down. In the end, half of us didn't know where the hell we were or what we were supposed to be doing. I just kept going, doing my absolute best through the roars of abuse and the flying spray of the power hoses, push-ups, sit-ups, screw-ups. It was now all the same to me. Every muscle in my body ached to hell, especially those in my stomach and arms. And finally, Schultz offered us mercy and a quiet drink. "Hydrate!" he yelled with that old-world charm that came so naturally to him, and we all reached for our canteens and chugged away. "Canteens down!" bellowed Schultz, a tone of pained outrage in his voice. "Now push 'em out!" Oh, yes, of course. I'd forgotten all about that. I'd just had a 9-second break. Down we all dropped again and went back to work with the last remnants of our strength, counting the push-ups. We only did 20 that time. Schultz must have been seized by an attack of conscience.
"Get in the surf," he bawled, "right now."
We floundered to the beach and darn near fell into the surf. And when we splashed back to the beach, Chief Schultz was there, ranting and yelling for us to form up and run the mile to the chow hall.
"Get moving," he added. "We don't have much time."
When we arrived, I was just about dead on my feet. I didn't think I had the energy to chew a soft-boiled egg. We walked into that chow hall like Napoleon's army on the retreat from Moscow, wet, bedraggled, exhausted, out of breath, too hungry to eat, too battered to care. It was, of course, all by design. This was not some kind of crazed Chinese fire drill arranged by the instructors. This was a deadly serious assessment of their charges, a method used to find out in the hardest way possible who really wanted to do this, who really cared enough to go through with it. Who could face the next 4 weeks before Hell Week when things got seriously tough? It was designed to compel us to reassess our commitment. Could we really take this punishment? 98 of us had formed up on the grinder 2 hours earlier. Only 66 of us made it through breakfast. And when that ended, we were still soaked, boots, long pants, and t-shirts. And once more, we set off for the beach, accompanied by an instructor who showed up from nowhere, running alongside us, shouting for us to get moving. We'd been told what awaited us, a 4-mile run along the beach, going south, 2 down and 2 back. 32 minutes on the stopwatch was allowed, and God help anyone who could not run 8-minute miles through the sand. I was afraid of this, because I knew I was not a real fast runner, and I psyched myself up for a maximum effort. Our instructor, Chief Ken Taylor, lined us up and warned us darkly of the horrors to come if 32 minutes proved to be beyond some of us, and sent us away, with the sun now climbing out of the Pacific to our right. The first 2 miles were not that awful. I was up there in the first half of the class, and I was not feeling too bad. On the way back, though, I was flagging. I glanced around, and I could see everyone else was also looking really tired. And right then, I decided to hit it. I turned up the gas and thumped my way forward. Every time I caught a guy, I treated it as a personal challenge and pulled past him, finally clocking a time well inside 30 minutes, which wasn't half bad for a pack horse. I forget who the winner was, probably some hickory-tough farm boy petty officer, but he was a couple of minutes better than I was. Anyway, the guys who made the time were sent up into the soft sand to rest and recover. There were about 18 guys outside 32 minutes, and one by one they were told, "Drop!" then start pushing them out. Most of them were on their knees with exhaustion, and that kind of saved them a step in the next evolution, which was a bear crawl straight into the Pacific, directly into the incoming surf. Instructor Taylor had them go in deep until the freezing cold water was up to their necks. They were kept there for 20 minutes, very carefully timed, I now know, to make sure no one developed hypothermia. Taylor and his men even had a pinpoint accurate chart that showed precisely how long a man could stand that degree of cold. And one by one, they were called out and given the most stupendous hard time for failing to achieve the 32-minute deadline. As those poor guys came out of the surf, Chief Taylor, the Genghis Khan of the beach gods, ordered these half-dead, half-drowned, half-frozen guys to lie on their backs, their heads and shoulders in and under the water with the rhythm of the waves, and he made them do flutter kicks. There were guys choking and spluttering and coughing and kicking and God knows what else. Next evolution? Log PT. brand new to all of us. We lined up wearing fatigues and soft hats. 7-man boat crews standing right by our logs, each of which was 8 feet long and a foot in diameter. I can't remember the weight, but it equaled that of a small guy, say 150 to 160 pounds. I was just moving into pack horse mode when the instructor called out, "Go get wet and sandy!" All in our nice dry clothes, we charged once more to the surf, up and over a sand dune, and down into the water. We rushed out of the waves and back up the sand dune, rolled down the other side, then stood up like the lost company from the U.S. Navy sandcastle platoon. Then he told us to get our logs wet and sandy. So we heaved them up, waist high, and hauled them up the sand dune. We ran down the other side, dumped the goddamn log in the ocean, pulled it out, went back up the sand dune, and rolled it down the other side. The crew next to us somehow managed to drop their log on the downward slope. "You ever, ever drop one of my logs again," the instructor bellowed. "I can't even describe what'll happen to you. All of you. Get wet and sandy!" Back down to the surf, into the waves, into the sand. By this time, guys really were on their last legs, and the instructors knew it. To our total amazement, they concluded the morning by telling us we'd done a damn nice job, made a great start, and to head off now for chow. A lot of us thought this was encouraging. 7 of our number, however, were not to be consoled by these calming words, uttered by guys who should have been riding with Satan's cavalry in Lord of the Rings. They went straight back to the grinder and handed in their helmets, placing them in a line outside the CO's door. That's the way it's done in first phase, the exit ritual. There were now 12 helmets signifying resignation, and we hadn't even had lunch on day one. I can't remember the precise time Hell Week started, but it was after 2030 and before 2100. Suddenly there was a loud shout, and someone literally kicked open the side door of the classroom we'd been locked in all afternoon. Bam! And a guy carrying a machine gun, followed by 2 others, came charging in, firing from the hip. The lights went off, and then all 3 gunmen opened fire, spraying the room with bullets. Blanks, I hoped. There were piercing blasts from whistles, and the other door was kicked open, and 3 more men came crashing into the room. The only thing we knew for sure right now was when the whistles blew, we hit the floor and took up a defensive position, prostrate, legs crossed, ears covered with the palms of the hands.
"Hit the deck! Heads down! Incoming!"
Then a new voice, loud and stentorian. It was pitch dark, save for the nonstop flashes of the machine guns, but the voice sounded a lot like Instructor Murrock's to me.
"Welcome to hell, gentlemen."
For the next couple of minutes, there was nothing but gunfire, deafening gunfire. They were certainly blanks, otherwise half of us would have been dead, but believe me, they sounded just like the real thing, SEAL instructors firing RM43s. The shouting was drowned by the whistles, and everything was drowned by the gunfire. By now, the air in the room was awful, hanging with the smell of cordite, lit only by the muzzle flashes. I kept my head well down on the floor as the gunmen moved among us, taking care not to let hot, spent cartridges land on our skin. I sensed a lull, and then a roar, plainly meant for everyone.
"All of you out! Move, you guys, move! Move, move! Let's go!"
I struggled to my feet and joined the stampede to the door. We rushed out to the grinder where it was absolute bedlam. More gunfire, endless yelling, and then again the whistles, and once more we all hit the deck in the correct position. In barrels around the grinder's edge, artillery simulators blasted away. Then the instructors opened fire for real, this time with high-pressure hoses aimed straight at us, knocking us down if we tried to get up. The place was awash with water, and we couldn't see a thing, and we couldn't hear anything above the small arms and artillery fire. Battlefield whistle drills were conducted in the midst of high-pressure water jets, total chaos, deafening explosions, and shouting instructors,
"Crawl to the whistle, men! Crawl to the whistle! And keep your goddamn heads down!"
Some of the guys were suffering from mass confusion. One of them ran for his life, straight over the beach and into the ocean. He was a guy I knew really well, and he'd lost it completely. This was a simulated scene from the Normandy beaches, and it did induce a degree of panic, because no one knew what was happening, or what we were supposed to be doing besides hitting the deck. The instructors knew this. They understood many of us would be at a low ebb, not me. I'm always up for this kind of stuff, and anyway, I knew they weren't really trying to kill us. But the instructors moved among us, imploring us to quit now while there was still time.
All you gotta do is ring that little bell up there.
Lying there in the dark and confusion, freezing cold, soaked to the skin, scared to stand up, I told one of them he could stick that little bell straight up his ass, and I heard a loud roar of laughter. Then I heard a voice announcing we were a man short. Then I heard another voice, sharp and demanding. I don't know who it was, but it was close to me, and it sounded like the biggest boss man, Joe McGuire, with a lot of authority.
What do you mean, a man short? Get a count right now!
They ordered us to our feet instantly, and we counted off one by one, stopping at 53. We were a man short. Holy shit, that's bad, and very serious. Even I understood that. A party was dispatched immediately to the beach, and that's where they found the missing trainee, splashing around out in the surf. Someone reported back to the grinder, and I heard our instructor snap,
"Send them all into the surf. We'll sort them out later."
And off we went again, running hard to the beach, away from the gunfire, away from this madhouse, into the freezing Pacific in what felt like the middle of the night. As so often, we were too wet to worry, too cold to care. But when we were finally summoned out of the surf, something new happened. The whistles began blasting again, and this meant we had to crawl toward the whistles all over again. But this time not on the smooth blacktop, this time on the soft sand. In moments we looked like sand beetles groping around the dunes. The whistles kept blowing, one blast, then two, and we kept right on crawling. And by now my elbows were really getting hot and sore, and my knees were not doing that great either. All four joints felt red raw, but I kept moving. Then the instructors ordered us back into the surf, deep, so we could stay there for 15 minutes, maximum immersion time in water hovering just under 60 degrees. We linked arms until we were ordered out to more whistles and more crawling. Then they sent us down to the surf for flutter kicks, heads in the waves. Then more whistles, more crawling, and back into the water for another 15 minutes. Right next to me, one of the top guys in the class, an officer and a boat crew leader, great runner, good swimmer, quit unconditionally. This was a real shaker. Another officer and his crew went running up the beach after him, imploring him not to go, telling the intending instructor on his behalf the guy did not mean it. No, sir. The instructor gave him another chance, told him it wasn't too late, and if he wished, he could go right back into the water. But the man's mind was made up. Closed to all entreaties, he kept walking, and the instructor told him to get in the truck right next to the ambulance. Then he asked the guy doing the pleading if he wanted to quit too, and we all heard the sharp negative. And we saw the guy running like a scalded cat down the beach to join us in the water. The temperature seemed to grow colder as we jogged around in the freezing surf, and finally they called us out and the whistles blew again. We all dived back onto the sand, crawling, itching, and burning. Five guys quit instantly and were sent up to the truck. Anyway, right now we were ordered to grab the boats and get them in the surf, which we did without much trouble. But they made us paddle hundreds of yards, dig and row, lift and carry, dump boat and right boat, swim the boat, walk the boat, run the boat, crawl, live, die. We were so exhausted it didn't matter. We hardly knew where we were. We just floundered on with bloody knees and elbows until they ordered us out of the water. I think it was just before midnight, but could have been Christmas morning. We switched to log PT in the surf. No piece of wood in all of history, except possibly the massive wooden cross carried to Calvary by Jesus Christ, was ever heavier than our 8-foot hunk of wood that we manhandled in the Pacific surf. After all of our exertions, it was a pure backbreaker. Three more men quit. Then the instructors came up with something new and improved. They made us carry the boats over the O course and manhandle them over the goddamn obstacles. Another man quit. We were down to 46. Right then we switched to rock portage and charged back down the beach to get the IBS into the water. We crashed through the light incoming waves like professionals and paddled like hell, using the remnants of our strength to the rocks opposite the Hotel del Coronado. My swim buddy, Matt McGraw, was calling the shots in our boat by now, and we drove forward, crashed straight into the rocks, and the bowline man leaped for his life and grabbed onto the painter. We steadied the boat with the oars, and I thought we were doing real good. Suddenly, the instructor, standing up on top of the rocks right there at damn near 2 o'clock in the morning, bellowed at our crew officer,
You, sir, you just killed your entire squad. Stop getting between the boat and the rocks.
We hauled the boat out of the water, over the rocks, and onto the sand. The instructor gave us two sets of push-ups and sent us back the way we came. Twice more we assaulted the rock, slowly and clumsily, I suppose, and the instructor never stopped yelling his freaking head off at us. In the end, we had to run the boat back along the beach, drop it, and get right back into the surf for flutter kicks with heads and shoulders in the water, then push-ups in the surf, then sit-ups. Two more men quit. These DORs happened right next to me, and I distinctly heard the instructor give them another chance, asking them if they wanted to reconsider. If so, they were welcome to press on and get back in the water. One of them wavered, said he might, if the other guy would join him. But the other guy wasn't having it.
I'm done with this shit, he said, and I'm out of here.
They both quit together, and the instructor looked like he could not give a flying fuck. I later learned that when a man quits and is given another chance and takes it, he never makes it through. All the instructors know that. If the thought of DOR enters a man's head, he is not a Navy SEAL. I guess that element of doubt forever pollutes his mind. And puffing, sweating, steaming down there on that beach on the first night of Hell Week, I understood it. I understood it because that thought could never have occurred to me. Not while the sun still rises in the east. All the pain in Coronado could not have inserted that poison into my mind. I might have passed out, had a heart attack, or been shot before a firing squad, but I never would have quit. Soon as the quitters had gone, we were put right back to work, lifting the boats into a head carry for the run over to the chow hall, only another mile. When I got there, I was as close to collapse as I'd ever been. But they still made us push them out, lift the boat, to work up an appetite, I suppose. Eventually, they freed us to get breakfast. We had lost 10 men during the 9 hours that had passed since Hell Week began. Inside the chow hall, some of the guys were shell-shocked. They just sat staring at their plates, unable to function normally. I was not one of them. I felt like I was on the edge of starvation, and I steamed into those eggs, toast, and sausages, relishing the food, relishing the freedom from the shouts and commands of the instructors. Like the remnants of a ravaged army. I have to admit that after the first straight 30 hours, my memory of those 5 days begins to grow a little hazy. Not of the actual events, but of the sequence. When you're moving on toward 40 hours without sleep, the mind starts playing tricks, causing fleeting thoughts suddenly to become reality. You jerk yourself awake and wonder where the hell you are and why your mom, holding a big, juicy New York sirloin, is not pulling the paddle right next to you. It's the forerunner to outright hallucination. Kind of semi-hallucinations. They start slowly and get progressively worse. Mind you, the instructors do their level best to keep you awake. We were given 15 minutes of hard physical training, both when we reached the chow hall and when we left. We were sent into the surf fast and often. The water was freezing, and every time we carried out boat drills, racing through the breakers with the 4 remaining teams, we were ordered to dump boat, pull that sucker over on top of us, then right it, get back in, and carry on paddling to our destination. Most of us ate an early dinner, looking like a group of zombies, and right afterward we were marched outside to await further orders. I remember that 3 guys had just quit, simultaneously, which put us down to 6 officers out of the original 12. But I held on. So did most of us. But another officer climbed out of the water early and quit. He was the best swimmer in the class. This was a stunning blow, both to him and the rest of us. The instructor let him go immediately and just carried on counting off the minutes the rest of us were submerged. When we were finally back on shore, I was not really able to speak, and neither was anyone else, but we did some more PT, and then they ordered us back into the water for another period, I forget how long, maybe 5-10 minutes. Now the instructors knew we were right on the edge, and they came around with mugs of hot chicken broth. I was shaking so much I could hardly hold the cup. But nothing ever tasted better. They made us run around a long loop, carrying the boat on our heads, and then they made us race without it. This was followed by another long period in the water, at the end of which this member of the crew of Boat One, a tough-as-nails Texan, I thought, cracked up with what felt like appendicitis. Whatever it was, I was absolutely unreachable. I didn't even know my name, and I had to be taken away by ambulance and revived at the medical center. When I regained consciousness, I got straight out of bed and came back. I would not discuss quitting. I remember the instructors congratulating me on my new warm, dry clothes and then sending me straight back into the surf.
Better get wet and sandy, just in case you forget what you're doing here.
The injury list grew longer. Cuts, sprains, blisters, bruises, pulled muscles, and maybe 3 cases of pneumonia. We worked through the night, making one long 6-mile paddle, and reported for breakfast again at 0500 on Wednesday. We'd had no sleep for 3 days, but no one else quit. We had 36 guys left. We were in the final stages of Hell Week, and before us was the fabled around-the-world paddle, the last of the major evolutions of the week. We boarded the boats at around 19:30 and set off, rushing into the surf off the Special Warfare Center and paddling right around the north end of the island and back down San Diego Bay to the amphibious base. No night, in my experience, has ever lasted longer. Some of the guys really were hallucinating now, and all 3 of the boats had a system where one could sleep while the others paddled. I cannot explain how tired we were. Every light looked like a building dead in our path. Every thought turned into reality. If you thought of home, like I did, you thought you were rowing straight into the ranch. The only saving grace was, we were dry. But one guy on our boat was so close to breakdown, he simply toppled into the water. Still holding his paddle, still stroking, kicking automatically, and continuing to row the boat. We dragged him out, and he did not seem to understand he'd just spent 5 minutes in San Diego Bay. In the end, I think we were all paddling in our sleep. I locked one thought into my brain and kept it there. Everyone else who ever became a U.S. Navy SEAL completed this, and that's what we're gonna do. Mr. Burns stepped forward and shouted,
"Okay, guys, let's get right on to the next evolution. A tough one, right? But I think you're up for it."
We gave out the world's weakest hoo-yah. Hoarse voices, disembodied sounds. I didn't know who was speaking for me. I sure as hell sounded like someone else. Joe Burns nodded curtly and said,
"Actually, guys, there is no other evolution. All of you, back to the grinder."
No one believed him, but Joe wouldn't lie. He might fool around, but he would not lie. It slowly dawned on us that Hell Week was over. We just stood there, zonked out with pure disbelief, and Lieutenant Ismay, who was really hurting, croaked,
"We made it, guys. Son of a bitch. We made it."
This was an unforgettable moment. 2 guys fell to their knees and wept. Then we all began to hug one another. Someone was saying, "It's over." Like the remnants of a ravaged army, we helped one another back over the sand dunes, picking up those who fell, supporting those who could barely walk. We reached the bus that would take us back to base, and there, waiting for us, was Captain Joe McGuire, the SEAL commanding officers, and the senior chiefs. Also in attendance was the ex-SEAL governor of Minnesota, Jesse Ventura, who would perform the official ceremony when we returned to the grinder. But right now, all we knew was the baptism of fire that had reduced Class 226 by more than half was over. It hadn't beaten 32 of us, and now the torture was completed. In our wildest imaginations, no one had ever dreamed it would be this bad. God had given us justice. We lined up on that sacred blacktop, and Governor Ventura formally pronounced the official words that proclaimed we never had to tackle another Hell Week. "Class 226, you're secured." We gave him a rousing, "Hoo-yah, Governor Ventura!" Then Instructor Burns called us to order and said,
"Gentlemen, for the rest of your lives there will be setbacks, but they won't affect you like they will affect other people. Because you have done something very few are ever called upon to achieve, this week will live with you for all of your lives. Not one of you will ever forget it, and it means one thing above all else. If you can take Hell Week and beat it, you can do any damn thing in the world."
"Hoo-yah, Instructor Burns!"
we bellowed. And did we ever mean it.
"Bye, dudes. Give 'em hell."
As day broke over the mighty sprawl of the U.S. base at Bagram in Afghanistan on that morning in March 2005, we checked into our B hut and slept for a few hours before attending a general briefing. Dan Healy, Shane, James, Axe, Mikey, and I, the new arrivals from SDV Team 1, were immediately seconded to SEAL Team 10 out of Virginia Beach, led right now by the Teak Hard Lieutenant Commander Eric Christensen. Eric was funny as hell. Always one of the boys, so much so it might have impeded his progress through the higher ranks in later years. These days, 75% of all SEALs have college degrees, and the line between officers and enlisted men